Welcome to Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today from Devereaux, we have Todd Harris, PhD, the Executive Director of Autism Services. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, you've got a tough act to follow. We had Dr. Graham, Yolanda Graham, was on the show in the past fall, and she was just fantastic talking about the services that are offered there. But so let's get started with anyone who's unfamiliar with Devereaux. Can you give us some, the elevator speech about what is Devereaux?
Sure. Devereaux Advanced Behavioral Health is a national behavioral organization. And we're in 13 different states currently. So I think as far north as Massachusetts, as far south as Florida, and as far west as California. So we have states certainly in between. We're serving individuals from birth to geriatric populations, and we serve a variety of different types of individuals, individuals with mental health challenges, individuals with intellectual disabilities, individuals with autism. At last check, I think we were employing around 7,000 staff, and we're serving currently about 1,500 individuals with autism. And that's an underestimate. We actually are serving, I think, a lot more through our consultation and training program, but we know at least 1,500. We're looking at services across all our populations that are characterized by three different things. First and foremost, they have to be individualized for the individual and their family. They have to be effective and accountable. So we have a significant emphasis on using evidence-based practices. And they need to be positive and proactive. So we're providing these services. We're really looking at building skills through positive approaches. And we're really looking at improving and enhancing quality of life. That's the key for us, is we want to make sure that the individuals we serve, as well as their families, have the highest quality of life possible.
You want to briefly tell us a little bit about your role at Devereaux?
Sure. So I am the Executive Director of Autism Services. So I think at its core, my job is to ensure that all our centers are using evidence-based practices and interventions. So I need to work with the centers and help them build capacity. I help with training and training initiatives. So, for example, right now we're looking at positive behavior interventions and supports. So that's a multi-tiered system of support. So at its core, at tier one, we're looking at what does every environment need to have to be effective at teaching skills and supporting individuals so they can have a high quality of life. And that's going to work for most of the individuals that we serve. But for some individuals, that won't be enough. So we're looking at tier two supports and tier three supports, especially for those individuals that are still having a lot of behavioral challenges. So I'm helping lead the organization in PBIS. And we're also, in terms of autism training initiatives, we're looking at developing training systems for how to most effectively teach individuals with autism to communicate. We're looking at teaching our clinicians to effectively address and reduce unsafe and unwanted behavior through positive approaches. And we're also looking at different service lines right now to kind of expand what we're doing. For example, we're about to start a parent training program that's run through an outpatient clinic. So parents will come in either 12 or 15 times, maybe about once a week, and receive training on how to best work with their son or their daughter with autism. That will be coupled with home visits and even observing families in community settings to make sure that they can do well in terms of providing instruction in community settings. So those are some of the things, some of the initiatives that I've been working on.
This is all, though, geared towards living with. We're not talking cures, et cetera. We're talking about living with.
That's correct. That's correct. We, you know, autism is something that you're born with. I think that early on, and still a little bit today, some people are promoting cures for autism, but autism is a biological disorder, and it's a lifelong disorder, in my opinion. So if you're born with autism, you'll have autism your whole life. With that being said, that doesn't mean that you can't significantly improve your skills and have a really highly productive, high quality of life moving forward if you get the right interventions and the right supports.
Well, people in the most accepted form of successful people, a lot of successful people, money, family, et cetera, have odd quirks that today might actually put them on the autism spectrum disorder chart.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what do we know about autism? Before the show began, I almost joked. I said, we talk a lot about what we don't know. What causes it? Is it something after birth? Is it genetic? It's like we don't know so much about it. Is there anything we actually do know about autism?
Well, I think you're very accurate in stating there's a lot that we don't know, especially about what causes autism. We do know it's a genetic disorder. There's a strong genetic influence, and we know that it's a biological disorder. So you don't develop autism after you're born. It's not something that due to trauma, all of a sudden you develop autism. That was early on. That was the belief about etiology and how autism was formed. But we now know that this is a biological disorder that you're born with. We know a couple other things as well. On the good news front, we know that there's a lot of interventions that have a lot of evidence behind it, that from a scientific standpoint have been demonstrated repeatedly to be effective. A lot of those interventions are associated with applied behavior analysis, which is a scientific approach to teaching skills and helping reduce behaviors that are unsafe. On the bad news front, we also know that autism is increasing fairly significantly. So when I first started in the field, it was in the 80s. I'm going to say mid-80s. Went to worked for a while in the field as a direct care professional, and then I decided there's a lot I need to learn, and so I need to go back to school. So I started in a master's program and then ended up in a doctoral program at the University of Massachusetts that focused on autism and applied behavior analysis. So I thought this is perfect for me. Part of my requirements during that time were to, one of the requirements was to write a paper on autism. So I had to look at prevalence rates. So how often is autism occurring presently? At the time, the number I very distinctly remember, because I had to write it over and over and explain it to people, was 4.5 for every 10,000 births. So if you do the math, that's about 1 in 2,250, approximately. It might be 2,225. But if you kind of move forward 30 years now, we're looking at 1 in 59 is the estimate. So for every 59 or 60 children being born, the estimate is that one of them will have autism. So that's a significant increase over the past 30 years. And even in the last 10 years, I believe that the prevalence rates 10 years ago were about 1 in 110. So even from that time in the last 10 years, we're seeing an alarming increase.
But again, is that partially due to the broadening of the definition or recognition that somebody, as I mentioned earlier, somebody who 30 years ago was considered quirky or odd or, but again, successful in life and fully integrated into everyday situations, now would be diagnosed?
Yes, I think that's correct. So I think that there's a couple different reasons, and you stated some of them. So we have better diagnostic assessment tools. We have a definition of autism that I think is quite broader than it used to be. So we're catching more children in terms of diagnostics that way as well. There's a greater community awareness. When I first started in the field in the 80s, no one really knew what autism was. It really came down to, I think, when Rain Man came out. I'm going to take a guess and say that was around 1988, that people started to talk a little bit about autism. So when they asked me what I did, I was able to explain to them, and they knew a little bit because they saw Rain Man, even though Rain Man represented just a small kind of sliver of what people like or people with autism are like. So I think we're seeing all those variables, but I do believe that it's actually occurring more as well. Okay. So I think it's a combination of all those variables.
Well, then let's go back to diagnosis. What is needed to put somebody within the ASD category?
I think it needs to be a structured assessment. We actually have some very strong assessment tools now. There's something called the ADOS, which is the gold standard right now. So if families are seeking out some diagnostic work on their child, I would recommend that they ask for an ADOS. And I think that the other piece of it, too, is too often parents are asked to take their child into a clinic. So it's unknown setting, a setting that's very different and strange around people they don't know, and they don't always act naturally, which is not a big surprise to us, right? So I think that if we could also make sure that whatever assessment is done, that the assessment is done by a clinician that also sees the child in their natural setting, so they can see more natural interactions, I think that's important too.
When you just mentioned interaction, is that key to a diagnosis, how one interacts?
It is. It's really important. First and foremost, when you look at autism and the question is, like, what really does it entail? There's three core elements to autism that we look at. The first is social skills. And I think the most important piece of this is social skills. So how does an individual interact? I think too often people believe that if you have autism, you don't like people. And that's not actually true. I think that's a myth. What I found is that people with autism actually really enjoy other people and like people. But they have preferences that we need to understand. And the preferences are related to how they interact, when they interact with individuals, what does that look like? So their preferences are different than our preferences, and I think we have to take that into account. There's also social skill deficits and some lack of responsivity. So when I was doing diagnostics, gosh, I think it was about 20 years ago, as part of a job, we were looking at if someone walks in the room and I'm sitting with a child with autism, do they look up to see who it is or do they not? That was one of the things that we looked at is social interest. If I come and sit down next to the child, I'm the new person in the room, and I sit down and smile and say hi, do they look at me? Do they interact with me? Are they able to imitate my actions? Those are some of the things that we absolutely look at. And then we're looking at social skills, and we're talking about a spectrum disorder. So there's a wide range of different types of skills we'll see. On the kind of less challenged, and I'm trying to think of a better way to frame that, but I'm going to go with that for right now. We see individuals that interact frequently but have what you would call awkward social skills. So they have a lot of difficulty interacting with others. They might say things that are out of context, or we might think, huh, that was kind of inappropriate. They don't understand social rules. Little things like when do you say thank you? When do you hold the door open for somebody? Those are things that we eventually pick up and our kids pick up over time. But a lot of individuals with autism don't understand that right away. On the more challenged end, we're looking at individuals that are unable to greet others, who may not be able to answer or ask questions, and so on. So that's the one area, social skills. But we're also looking at communication. So do they have the ability to express themselves? Some individuals have words but don't use those words to communicate early on. And then some individuals that I work with, actually I would say probably about half the individuals that I work with are nonverbal. And they also don't understand language from others. So these receptive skills, the ability to understand whether it's verbal or nonverbal communication, can be a real challenge. And then the third area that we look at are just behavioral and sensory challenges. So we see individuals that have a lot of sensory needs and sensory preferences. So things like us, I worked with somebody who, a young child, who would have tantrums now and then. And it was really intermittent, and we couldn't figure out why. Until finally, there was a classroom aide in his classroom who said, it seems like every time the air conditioning goes on, he starts to get really upset. So we determined that over time that he was having issues based on that noise, and that noise was really bothering him.
Before we move into an area we really need to discuss is aging with the ASD. What's the difference in diagnosing boys and girls? Do girls get diagnosed later? And I'm only asking because it's interesting. I've seen some blogs and articles recently from women who say, wow, it was when my child was diagnosed that they said, well, you noticed that you too probably would fit in this definition.
Mm-hmm. I think that the difference is, it's interesting because it's not been looked at in the scientific literature extensively. They're just now looking at it more and more. First and foremost, the most prominent thing that we have established is that autism is primarily a boy disorder. So the ratio from boys to girls with autism is about 4-to-1. When I first started at Devereaux, I was working as the director of a private school, and we were just starting to build the number of kids there. And we went from, I think, 15 to 30 fairly quickly. And I realized we were at 30, and we didn't have one girl in the school. It was all boys. So I think that we're looking at a 4-to-1 ratio that could be as high in some research as 12-to-1. I think it's probably somewhere in between. I do believe that the profile seems to be a little bit different for girls, and I think we still need to look at that more carefully. And it might be that girls are also being diagnosed at a later age. Right now, probably about 10 years ago, the average age of diagnosis was probably 6 or 7. We're, I think, more and more looking at around 4 years now as the average age of diagnosis. So I'd be interested. I don't know exactly if girls have a later date of diagnosis or not, but I think that's something to look at.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today from Devereaux Advanced Behavioral Health, we have its Executive Director of Autism Services, Todd Harris, PhD. And if you'd like more information about anything that we talk about, Devereaux does have amazing resources available to the general population. Go to their website, devereaux.org. That's Devereux, Devereaux.org. Now, let's get back into this, because you just said that right now, a person is four or five when they are diagnosed. And obviously, the earlier you're diagnosed, the sooner interventions and care can be applied. But you talked about you get started in this mid-80s, late 80s. Mm-hmm. So a kid who's 4 years old then is probably about 40 years old at this point.
Correct.
And if we're getting more and more diagnoses each year, what is going to be happening as you know, the decades go by? If we're getting more and more in this population, we're seeing more and more museums and theatrical companies and movie theaters. Big pizza chain actually has dedicated days to sensory-friendly family days, et cetera. We're becoming more accommodating, but are we assimilating enough? And what's going to happen as these kids hit employment age, living alone age, et cetera, et cetera?
So I think that right now, as you pointed out, a young child with autism will become an adult with autism. And they're going to be an adult a lot longer than they are a child. So we really need to look at that. Early on, most of the research, when you're looking at scientific research on what works and what are good service lines for individuals with autism, most of that research has been geared towards children. We're just now starting to be better at looking at studying in a scientific way what's working with adults. So we need to get much better at what interventions actually work with adults. We have what we call a wave, or some people are calling it a tsunami, of numbers that are now young people with autism, young adults that are 16, 17, and so on, up to 21, that their needs are being met within school-based services currently. But at age 21, and that's a mandate, at age 21, that mandate goes away, and individuals are then transitioned into adult services. So I think the good news is we do know more and more about how to better support adults with autism and what that looks like. But I think because the numbers are growing, and they're going to grow and be much larger in the next 10, 20, and 30 years, I think the systems right now are not ready for that. And I think that's my biggest concern. Nationwide, we are not ready for the numbers that are going to be entering into adult services. The services currently are stretched thin. We don't have enough money in terms of funding of important supports that we know work. And then the staff currently don't have the capacity to implement on a consistent basis evidence-based practices consistently. And certainly there are model programs and good programs out there that do that. But by and large, what we're finding is the staff need a lot more training and support to be effective at supporting the adults with autism they're working with.
Are we looking at a lifetime of accommodations?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely.
And by that, define what I just said.
Well, I think we're looking at, you know, we are able to diagnose children as early as a year, year and a half. And so the services need to start. As you mentioned, it's important that the services start right away and that they're effective and science-based services. But we're looking also at adults and geriatric populations as well. I was consulting on a case, and it was an individual who was around 62, 63, and he was going to every day a day program. And it was a program he went, mm-hmm. and he was expected to do some work. They had some rec leisure stuff that he could do. And he started to have behavioral issues around getting up in the morning and going to his day program. And so we sat down with the team. I found out his age. He had limited ability to communicate. So he was communicating a lot of his displeasure with the day program and not wanting to go through aggressive behaviors, which is why I was brought in. And so we started to have a conversation. And the one thing that never really occurred to anybody is the question about when does he get to retire? He's 62. There's individuals, a lot of people we know, who start to retire around 60, 62, 65. And I don't think the thought that he's allowed to retire ever entered the professionals that were working with him into their minds. They just weren't thinking about that. So what does not only that time from 21 to 65 look like, but what does retirement look like for adults with autism as they age? So I think that's going to be something that's really significant that we need to look at.
When you mentioned his age, I was thinking that did anyone ask maybe he is developing an arthritis or maybe he's having an underlying health condition that he's not able to express? Mm-hmm. And that might be an issue because they're also going to be aging into our healthcare system, not just intellectual disability services, but they're going to need all the routine healthcare that the rest of us need.
That's correct. And certainly children need healthcare and young adults need healthcare. But as you age, you need more and more health care. And if you don't have the ability to communicate, I have a headache, you know, my stomach's not feeling well, my knee really hurts, then it becomes even more of a challenge. So part of what we need to do is to make sure that the staff that are working with adults with autism are sensitive to changes in behavioral patterns and careful to watch individuals. Are they eating less all of a sudden? Are they limping? And to alert healthcare people right away. I think the other piece, too, that we need to get much better as a field, I believe, is to be more proactive and to really look at the development of healthcare and healthy lifestyles for individuals with autism starting when they're children. So there's some data. The other thing that we know is that individuals with autism tend to have a lot more problems with their health related to weight management. So the obesity rates in children with autism and adults with autism are much higher than their peers. So what can we do? And the other thing paired with that, well, a couple of things that lead to that. One is sedentary lifestyles in some cases, and in some cases, diets that are not healthy and difficulty regulating how much they eat. So these are things that we need to look at very early on and start establishing exercise routines, healthy eating routines, looking at the ability to control portions and so on.
We are running out of time. So let us really quickly then delve into Devereaux does a lot of its own research and it's working on this evidence-based approaches. So what has Devereaux got right now? I mean, what are we looking at programs there for older youth and adults?
So right now we have a couple things that we're doing. We provide a lot of consultation to schools. And when we talk about adults, we're consulting more and more on what we call transition programming. So that's programming for individuals that officially needs to start at 14. We like to start at a much earlier age, but at 14 years old to 21, we start gearing towards the transition to adulthood services. So we're providing consultation, looking at and helping school districts, as well as our own private schools, prepare those individuals for employment, for independent living, as much as they can live independently, for community living and community inclusion, as well as social connectedness. So we start there. And we provide consultation either directly or through our consultation and training program. And then we have a community-based program called CAP. CAP is the Community Adult Autism Partnership Program, and that's based somewhat nearby in Wayne, Pennsylvania. And we serve individuals from at least four or five different counties in that setting. And those are supports for community-based employment. So one of the things that we do is we work to make sure that individuals get a job that's a good fit for them. So we look at what are their preferences, what do they like to do, what are their strengths, and then instead of saying, well, let's open the want ads and let's try to find a match, see if we can find a job that's open, we'll actually do job seeking for them. So an individual armed with that information will go out into the community and talk to employers and try to find a good match. We also look at teaching individuals how to be as independent as possible where they live. So how to cook, how to do their laundry, how to make sure they are able to get to medical appointments, that they're using public transportation whenever possible. And that program also provides supports for community inclusion. So how to navigate a grocery store, for example. Those are things that sometimes individuals with autism have to be taught specifically. How to go into a restaurant and order from a menu. But probably the most important thing that we do in that program, and this is what the individuals that we serve tell us, is that we provide social activities and social connectedness. So we make sure that the individuals that we're serving have activities where they can meet up with friends on a weekly basis, multiple times a week, to either have dinner, to watch a movie together, and so on.
If someone is hearing this and they're starting to get concerned, and obviously you have to start planning, you know, from birth on for the years F21 on, what should parents do if they're hearing this? What's the takeaway, and how can Devereaux help with this?
I think the takeaway that I always tell parents is start planning as early as possible. And that's a hard thing to do. It's hard to think about your 8-year-old child being an adult someday. But when you have a child with autism, it's really important to start planning early on for that transition and to start teaching skills for independence. I think early on, you know, parents are obviously concerned about teaching communication skills. It's important to teach social skills, and those are really critical. And a lot of our families that I've worked with also focus on academic skills, and those are all important skills, but sometimes we forget independence. So, for example, if you have a 4-year-old, start teaching them to help clean up their room or clean up the room themselves with support and clean up their toys. Teach them how to use the bathroom appropriately without any kind of help. Teach them how to sit at a table and have a meal. We work with a lot of individuals that come to us and come to our school and won't sit when they eat. They might not be toilet trained. They don't know how to wash their hands. They don't know how to dress themselves. So those are all things that have to be taught. So try to teach those things early and know that you have a multi-year plan and work on independence. So communication and social skills are really critical. Academic skills, very important. But don't forget about the independent skills. That's really critical. And our programs really focus in on that. So our private schools, our consultation and training programs, and our transition to adulthood programs all focus on all of those things.
And again, of course, information about everything we've talked about is available at devereaux.org. D-E-V-E-R-E-U-X, devereaux.org. And from Devereaux Advanced Behavioral Health, we have its Executive Director of Autism Services, Todd Harris, Ph.D., today. Thank you for coming in.
Well, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it, and thanks for listening.
And if you're just joining us, of course, you can find a podcast of this show at Mix 995WJBR. And, of course, you can find more great podcasts at bpodstudios.com, the place to be for podcast discovery. I'm Laura Lewis, and this has been Focus on the Delaware Valley.